Hi, this is Sean Murphy. I'm here with Pete Torme, and we're talking about some of the challenges that early stage software entrepreneurs face in forming a company and pulling together as a team. Pete, you're a patent attorney with Antero Torme, and you work with a lot of early stage technology entrepreneurs.
Yes, I do. We get people who have, usually when they meet me, they have some type of thing, invention they want to go forward with. And often they've either just started a company and they're going forward with a patent, or they have a patent, an idea they want to bring forward, and they want to have a company to go about realizing their invention.
So one of the things we wanted to talk about today was dividing the pie once you incorporate. But I think there's a whole cluster of issues around what are the risks you face in kind of forming a team and making sure there's a market. Do you want to talk about the ideal scenario that you see or the recommended path that you see for that?
In the perfect scenario, you're going to have a team that's all pulling together in the same direction. And what you want to do when you start dividing up the equity pie is make sure that it's not too one-sided, one person or the other. And what that means is initially for the founders, you probably want to have something close to some even type of split. But I think a mistake people make is that they split up the whole pie. And without remembering that as the company grows, you're going to need to bring more and more people in. So you can have an even split. Just keep it a small proportion for everyone and agree that later on we'll sell off the other 60 or 70% of the company as we bring more and more people in.
And restricted stock or a vesting schedule is another way to do that, right?
Yeah, and vesting's great. If you're already incorporated, vesting's great. And the way that works is somebody agrees to purchase for some really cheap price a big block of stock. The company retains the right to buy that stock back. So you buy 100,000 shares, and I retain the right to buy it all back. But every month or every quarter or whenever it happens, I give you that stock exclusively. I no longer have the right to purchase it back. What that does is it tends to keep people on the team longer because their stock is they're getting more and more stock as they stick around. The downside to that, especially what I think with early stage bootstrapping companies, is having someone stick around isn't really necessarily what you want. What you really want is some type of milestones. You don't want to be in a situation of rewarding someone to stick around a long time if that's really not what your goal is. And with big companies, you have to reward them on time because you're going to have institutionalized functions. But at the bootstrapper level, you really have goals and objectives you're trying to meet more so than institutionalized functions that everyone's going to do.
I think when you reward hours, you tend to create effort and not results. I think that's one point. In terms of the even type of split, I think that if you're getting above 2-to-1 or certainly above 4-to-1 in terms of the percentage or the share count that one founder has versus from the most to the least, if that gets above 2-to-1 and certainly by 4-to-1, you're probably creating a lot of stress in that team that's going to be hard to survive. Somebody on the team doesn't belong, or somebody's got very inflated expectations of their value.
Yeah, and what happens is it makes other people bitter because they look at that person and they say, I'm doing all the work, and that person's getting more. And I think I see that a lot where we have a founder, someone who had the idea, who is mistaken belief that just because they have the idea, they should get most of everything. And the idea person over time becomes less and less value to the company. And it's the execution people. It's the people that can bring in the sales dollars. If the person with the idea is...
When you say idea guy, in that context, you mean an idea guy that can't either execute or sell, right?
Exactly. If the idea guy is a visionary and he has this patent and he knows what he's about, he can add a lot of value to the team. But I often see people that say, I have this idea, I'm going to patent it, and I want to get some other people to do it, and I want to keep most of it for myself. That's, to me, a recipe for failure. And it's the people that can take an idea and turn it into profit that are really add the value to the team.
We've kind of talked about the split. I think it'd be good to go back and look at a whole bunch of problems that crop up or problems you should be past or tests you should be past before you start talking about incorporating and creating an equity split, right?
Sure. Okay.
And I had a couple thoughts on that, at least for the bootstrapper side. If you're doing a service first kind of business where you're consulting or you're doing a concierge model where you're essentially manually implementing the product or you're selling a result, then you can split revenue before splitting equity, right? And coming up with a plain English agreement for how to do that might be one simple test. I think even earlier than that is just the ability to kind of set and hit joint deliverables or joint outcomes. That's a test for poor communication. What are some of your kind of early tests you look for in terms of as a team coming together?
Well, I think, and of course, looking at it from the legal perspective, we tend to focus a little bit on what can go wrong. I mean, that's the way we're trained. And I like to see clear expectations set as early as possible, and regardless of what they are, but the mutual understanding. And I think the problem is everyone thinks they have set clear expectations when they really haven't. And so it's not always easy to do. And sometimes when you're sitting across the table for you may be going into business with a friend, it's hard to say a sentence like, I expect you to have, you know, the next version by next Tuesday. That's very difficult. And in situations like that, you know, a written follow-up on email is a good idea. Get in the habit of emailing back and forth with each other because you can reiterate the conversation you had at lunch. And when you do that, you say, okay, we talked today, and my understanding is that the following is going to happen, or you're going to make the following happen, and I'm going to do the following. And you can lay out the expectations real early. Have a clear understanding of where you fit. You know, you've reached that agreement of where you're going to do your own work, and you understand where the other person's going to be. You have this kind of level of accountability that follows up. And I don't know about you, but for myself, I would often sit and, you know, we'd be having the meeting. We were starting a software company, sitting in the coffee shop, and you kind of nod your head yes to everything because you know it all should be done, but it needs to be broken out into manageable chunks and identify who's going to do it and when they're going to do it.
So I think there's a couple things about that is short deadlines. So you're kind of working in small batches, taking small steps. I think I fully endorse your idea of being clear about expectations, but I think you have to be careful that these expectations are formed when you have the least information about the problem in the market. You don't want that early ignorance to become a straitjacket on what's going to happen. I mean, essentially executing a plan that you made when you had the least amount of information is not a recipe for success.
Absolutely, and maybe one of the action items for hopefully one of the team members is to go find out if your underlying assumptions are true.
The way we look at it is that you start with kind of small mutual commitments and you set short deadlines, and then you, as you set and hit those early targets, you can become more ambitious, right? The other thing that can happen, even before incorporation, just can you say, okay, let's spend 2 hours and see if we can get something done. Let's spend 2 hours, set goals for something to be done by the end of the week, and come back together at the end of the week, things are done or not, right?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that, and I've heard you suggest that model before, simply because part of the thing you're trying to find out is if you're going to be married to this partner, because it's a lot like a marriage, right? Can you work with this person? And if you can do small projects together and find out how they work, you can find out quickly whether or not this person should be on the team with you or not, which is going to be critical to, you know, do I really communicate? You know, some people you just don't communicate with, right? You may talk a lot, you just don't reach that same level of understanding. So small tasks are good to tell you, first of all, you can work with this person, but also I believe that you want to feel momentum. What makes me want to work on a project is knowing that it's going forward. And if I make a commitment to you that I'll have something next week, I'm far more likely to meet that commitment if it's on a regular schedule and I feel that the project is getting bigger and bigger and bigger as we move forward.
The other thing we see, again, very early on, is you can actually just trade hours with people or kind of pick one or more workout buddies where you may have two different visions in two different companies, but you may have expertise that they need and they have expertise that you need. So maybe you've got a business guy and a more technical guy, and they've got different ideas for the products they want to work on. They can still trade hours and help each move their startup forward. I think that's a better way to get to know somewhere than at the very beginning argue about who's got the better idea or the better vision, and it becomes pointless. I think you can do this with several people at once, And over time, the visions may either converge or you've actually helped someone else out that you can call on later on, and you ultimately find a small team you can work with.
Yeah, and I think that works too, because fundamentally it's a barter model of getting things done. You're working, let's say you're writing the code. You need somebody to help you out on the market side as you're developing it. You think you know the market. Somebody can help you out and vice versa. The only caution I would give to that is you want to keep a clear line between what's my business and what's your business. Right, so that you're working, you're helping each other out, but make sure you haven't blurred the lines on what the business is until you agree this, okay, we're going to merge them together, or we're going to keep everything absolutely separate. And this matters a little bit in the event of an ugly divorce, when someone says, no, I own part of that business, I worked on it.
I think you've got to be explicit that I'm working on your business in exchange for you working on mine. You keep and own your business. I keep and own mine. And if we decide later on to do something, we will revisit how that split works.
Yeah. I haven't worked with anyone who's done that model, but it appeals to me because it's really fundamentally a labor barter. You're swapping labor with each other. And when you're starting off, labor is what you have. You have more labor than money. And so that's a great way to get that to happen.
So we see a lot of it just even in the regular bootstrapper world, right? In other words, instead of trying to pay somebody to fix something, maybe you can trade something they need for something that you need. Mm-hmm. Right? This is also a way teams form. We've looked at this. You mentioned the idea or the conceiving of this as a marriage. I think that there is a what's called a stable marriage problem, where you want to make sure that the equity split and the nature of the relationship is such that as the company grows, the person that you've brought on is not going to receive better and more compelling offers than staying and working with you, right? So you can't, you can initially make maybe a fantastic deal, and then a month later the person's working with somebody else because instead of only getting 5% of the company and doing all the work, they get a third of the company and they do, you know, a third of the work.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not saying I have a perfect solution for it, but I think a lot of that is understanding what your teammates really expect out of the project. And sometimes, you know, you hear about lifestyle business, and maybe your marketing person is really only in it for the lifestyle. They don't want to manage anything. They just want to do a little marketing work and that's it. Or maybe they only want to work on the latest technology, and when something new comes along, they're going to move. And if you're in that scenario, it doesn't mean you can't work with that. It's just nice to know in advance, and then you can plan a little bit for it. So that, and you've seen this, you see it in more established companies where people kind of self-define their roles and they only do that and they never move beyond their comfort zones, right? And we criticize that a lot. But it's perfectly reasonable in a bootstrapping environment. As long as you know that your co-founders are going to self-limit in some way and you can account for that and you've hopefully figured it out in advance, by, you know, having enough communication with them or seeing where it's going to go, you can deal with it on that level.
So there is the loss of interest problem. There is the bright and shiny object, kind of chasing bright and shiny objects. And certainly ADD is very helpful because it helps you get out of local minima, but it's also a pain in the ass because you can't focus. Sure. I don't find the lifestyle, what you're calling the lifestyle entrepreneur, as much of a problem as somebody that's just simply lacks realism about what's involved with actually making a business work. I find the life, what you're calling lifestyle are typically realistic about the level of commitment they're willing to make. It's the people that expect to make a lot of money fast or think that it's going to be not much work and a lot of money, that tend to fall out, tend to be more of a problem than somebody that says, look, I can give you 8 hours a week, or I'm going to stay involved until we get up to 6 people, and then that's too big for me. I think people that self-limit in some ways are easier to manage or easier to plan for than people that say, okay, this is such a good idea, we're all going to be millionaires by the end of the year.
Yeah, and I think that there's a disillusionment that comes with wild forecasts of profitability, because first of all, most of the time you're not going to hit them. So if you have 6 leaders, you're going to have a little bit of a problem. And if they're all in it for the money, they're fighting hard because they want to go for the big money. And any decision you make is keeping them from becoming a millionaire. So now the impact is much bigger. And if you have someone who's quite happy to go along with the single person vision and do their function, their role, then they're probably going to be much easier to work with as team members than having another, you know, a leader of the pack in the same room.
So it's a tricky thing. I think it's okay to have six leaders as long as they're leading in different aspects of the venture, right? As long as they're focused on different areas. I think most of the conflict comes when you've got three people that have very strong opinions about how the software should be architected, and nobody's got any idea how you're actually going to sell it. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And right. That's when you see, you know, the corporate dissolution work and stuff. What you see is exactly that scenario. The marketing person spends all their time trying to be a techie, and the techie spends all their time trying to be a marketing person, and that's a recipe for disaster, simply because it's not really their expertise. And it shows, I think, a real high level of distrust. When I see the person who should be the primary marketing sales CEO type function getting into the minutia of the technology, that's a red flag for me, unless that person comes out of the technology, a strong technology background.
No, I think that's a good one. The other thing I see that can be a problem is what I call waiting for Santa Claus, that you're hoping that the business will be funded without revenue. You can come up with a product which is so stunning and so compelling that just the sight of it or the sight of the demo will make you fundable. And certainly that happens from time to time, but that really treats the VC as the customer, which I think is a mistake for most teams.
Yeah, I think in the VC, you know, we're talking predominantly about bootstrapping today. The problem I have with getting outside money is, as an entrepreneur myself and having started businesses, when you bring outside money in, you're no longer the owner. You're now an employee, because you're responsible to the people who put the money up, me. I think that kind of supports what you were saying.
It's a tricky thing because I think you've got accountability all the way along. As you point out in the beginning, you've got peer accountability. I mean, people will simply vote with their feet and leave if you're not meeting your commitments. Very likely you've got a spouse or somebody else who's helping you make this happen, and they're counting on you to start to demonstrate some traction and to generate some revenue to be able to offset the time you're spending on this. I think once you hire people, you're certainly responsible for making sure they get paid. And if you're splitting revenue with people and the deal doesn't come off, I think there's accountability all the way through. There is something different if you've essentially, in taking on money, hired a boss. But
yes.
It's a tricky thing. We've talked about the risk of a bad equity split. I think that there's probably bigger risk in not picking the right markets or taking on a partner or a co-founder prematurely who's just the wrong fit. So I think there's something that's very attractive about all the detailed discussions about splitting the pie. I think that's maybe 10 to 20% of the risk compared to maybe half the risk in the market and a third of the risk in the partnership. And there's some amount of risk that you pick a product that can't be developed. But for the most part, we don't see teams failing because they staked out a technology that they couldn't actually implement. They picked the wrong market or they've got the wrong people on the team.
Yeah, my experience has been that they're really in the wrong market. They're the wrong product or the wrong market. And in the sense that there's a lot of times having a cash flow solves a lot of problems, at least for the short term. So if you have a bad team, people will stick around if the money's there or it looks like the money's going to be there. But if your product doesn't meet the market demand, if people aren't buying it and don't seem likely to buy it anytime in the near future, that to me is the number one failure that I see. And I often see teams work towards a short term. We're going to come up with some type of prototype. We're going to go test the market, see how it goes. You know, they call it pivot. We go do something else. But before that pivot, you're going out in the market and you're saying, okay, does this look viable? And getting that market information back. And that's when I see the failure. People kind of gel and they say, you know what? We just don't, now that we know more, we don't think this is going to be very profitable. And I see failure there the most, at least been my experience. That's where I see it fail the most. simply because they either couldn't get the investor, they couldn't get early clients, they didn't have anything to sell, and people tend to walk away at that point. Or they reach an understanding of what it's really going to take to do what their vision was, and people aren't willing to do that. Like, the commitment may be far greater. And so you sit there and you have that meeting and say, look, here's what we found. Here's what people are telling us. What do we want to do about it? And it's at that point where often the team will say, you know what, this is more than I bargained for. I want out. And I consider that more of a marketing and sales failure than it is necessarily a wrong team failure.
Well, one aspect of wrong team that you're normally very concerned about is hiring friends and family, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I realize it depends. Every family dynamic is different, but you really want to have people that you can level with, and it's very difficult sometimes when it's a family member, simply because your brother might be a great, advertising copywriter or something like that, and he'd love to help you out, and he sits there at the dinner table and says, "Man, I'll help you out. This sounds like a really fun project," but he's going to pay his own bills. And if he's not really an entrepreneur, you'll always be the back burner for him. And the rest of your team members are saying, hey, where's the ad copy? Where's the ad copy? And you're going, I'm waiting on my brother. And it's difficult to fire your brother without ruining, every Thanksgiving dinner for the rest of your life. So you have to have a family relationship where that you can actually get things done. And it's nice that they agree to help out. But my experience and the other people I know that have used family members has not been very positive.
We used to do a thing that we called the first nine employees, where we would have people plan out their first nine employees. And we realized that that's really not the way it works, that what you have are fractional people that get involved on a project basis. And so perhaps one way to immunize yourself against the hiring the family person to say, okay, ask your brother, your cousin, can you help me for a week on this? And put up, so I think it's very difficult to fire somebody, right, for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. You can pick a small project, and if they back burner it, then you simply let it go and you reassign it to somebody else. I think this fractional FTE model is one we see increasingly, and not just face-to-face kind of engagements, but also virtual admins, external bookkeeping services, external marketing services, external webmaster services.
Well, I think when you look at initial employees, my experience has been that the first employee I want to hire is another me, somebody that knows everything I know, that can go do what I do and be in two places at once. And usually when you're bootstrapping, especially if it's just a small team, everybody has to wear so many hats. It's really hard to figure out what function you can peel off and give to another person. When you break it, instead of traditional job descriptions, you're really looking at what our immediate need is. And that's probably how you have to look at those early stage employees, the first people you're going to bring on. Is it an administrative assistant that might be really making you more efficient? Or do you really need to bring in like a CFO type person or a bookkeeper type person or whatever it is, where the role is clearly defined? If you have a finance person, they're going to define the role pretty clearly for you. Whereas if you have an assistant, they'll do whatever you ask them to do as long as they know how to do it. And I think that assistant level might be the most critical person you need initially. And then you can go back and to do more traditional roles. For instance, a lawyer. Most companies don't need a lawyer on staff early on at all, and you may go quite big before you have a lawyer on staff, period. It's just not a function you necessarily need. You might need to be able to pick up the phone and ask a lawyer a question, just like you need to ask your CPA a question. But you probably don't need that function. You just need a small snippet of that function.
I think the another me model, I would look at it differently. I think you need somebody that shares your values and shares your passion for the problem or the customer type that you're working with. But I think it's better if they actually have different skills and different strengths. Most of the conflict we see on early teams is because two people are very strong in one area and they're neglecting another area where they're both weak. And so the technical person who hires another strong technical person, or the business person who hires another strong business person, typically doesn't do as well as somebody who finds somebody with complementary skills, right?
Exactly. And I think a lot of that is that kind of self-awareness to know what is it that I'm not doing well, right? What do I really need help with? I think that the entrepreneurs have a tendency, at least my experience with them, is to think that they're really doing everything well, and it takes a degree of maturity to realize, you know what, I'm not good at the sales function, or I'm not that good at a software developer.
I think the problem they have is that I know how to hire another me. I don't know how to hire somebody who's got different skills.
And they're probably not even sure what they're looking for when they talk to potential candidates or potential new hires or early partners, what they're really looking for. Because your comfort zone is going to, if you're a techie, your comfort zone is going to be to talk about techie. You're going to like a techie person. But if a salesperson comes in, you might not even know how to really communicate with them.
So I think that's where you can rely on your kitchen cabinet or on friends that you know and trust that have that skill to help take part in the interview process. That's one of the reasons we advocate forming an advisory board, whether it's informal or formal, early on, because it gives you more perspectives on potential situations you face, potential prospects you may be talking to, potential partners or employees you may be evaluating.
And I also find that on the advisory board level, the advisors see you differently than you see yourself, and they often very quickly figure out what you're not good at. They might not tell it to your face right away, but they'll you know, hopefully a good advisory board would be very frank, but people are uncomfortable being very frank. But hopefully they'll look around and say, well, you know what, you're really not that good at software development, and maybe you should start farming more of it out and spend time on what you're good at. And hopefully a good advisory board will identify those areas for you. And then, at the same time, have some contacts in the industry that can get the position filled.
I think two other categories of early risk that kill companies are where people take on a lot of financial risk in advance of revenue, or they sign, for example, a long-term lease, or they start to max out credit cards as opposed to making the hard choices about what not to spend money on. Are there other early failures that you look for to say, these guys are in trouble, they ought to fix this problem before they go forward?
Well, you mentioned debt, but cash flow is certainly one of them. At the end of the day, everything is going to be based on cash flow. And if you don't see a revenue stream and you're taking on a lot of debt, credit card debt, and all kinds of things people do, that tells you there's something wrong. Your minimum viable product is way too expensive, right? The viable means you're going to be able to generate some sort of revenue. Unless you're really looking for an infusion of cash somewhere else, you have to keep that cash flow as short as you can. Leases, especially any kind of long-term lease, you really have to question, especially in a software model, whether anyone should have a lease on anything for the long term. And I see a lot of people start, they get beautiful offices, they're very expensive, and they think they're going to have cash flow quickly to get into them, and they very quickly find that paying that rent is what's killing them. So you really, the fear of every entrepreneur, especially if you're pre-revenue stage, is looking out at your cash flow and seeing if it's manageable. And that should be a lot of time for the founders, a place where they put a lot of their effort. It's nice to say, okay, let's get the product out, let's get the marketing done and all that. But dollars are, in a way, how you keep score with how your business is doing. So keeping your eye on those dollars looking forward is a key function.
I think the thing that works against that, or something to be on guard for in terms of cash flow, is perfectionism in a couple different forms, where either you're following your own vision over what the prospects are telling you, or you're looking for smarter prospects, or you feel like you're creating artwork. It's your vision you want to implement, but you can't sell it. The other trap that people fall into, I think, is I'm embarrassed to show this because it's not good enough. And if customers are in pain, they'll accept partial solutions.
Sure, absolutely. And the myth of the perfect product, I mean, if there was a perfect product, I haven't seen it yet. There might be some simple ones that are perfect. What makes a product perfect or not is really its expectations, its price point, right? It may be, Windows might be a perfect product at $10 a copy, but it's not a perfect product at $100,000 a copy, right? So I think what happens is people personify their product because it's their baby, and any imperfection kills them. You know, and that prevents them from ever releasing a product. That's certainly a killer and a risk for companies, early stage companies. If it's never good enough, you're never going to get it out the door. What I find is the people who feel it's never good enough often affix the blame on the other members of the team for not making it good enough, right? And so it comes back often to a team member kind of problem.
Right, but the guy that's pointing his fingers is probably the problem. I think that the next thing that happens with the cash flow is you have to have a plan. If you're doing this part-time, either for how you give up other freelance or consulting revenue, or how you go to halftime in your job, or how you leave your job. And negotiating that kind of that ladder of feasible steps is a tricky one, right?
And I had, years ago, when I had my software company, one suggestion was give up your day job, work on the software company full-time, but take a part-time job doing anything for the short term. And you consider, you know, being a bartender or a waiter, you don't care as long as you make enough to carry your bills so that you can work full-time on the project. Other people have philosophies that if you don't, you know, that once you make the commitment, once you leave your day job, it'll force you to work harder and you'll be more successful. I'm not sure exactly how true that is, but certainly there's a motivator when you have no income to really work hard on getting your product out the door. You know, you're making your company successful. I don't always advise that, but it's certainly highly motivating.
So it's a tricky thing because it takes a long time sometimes to get something off the ground, and working two jobs is no worse a priority management problem that you're going to face as your business scales anyway. So what we call the work-work balance, where you've got some kind of other work you're doing to bring the money in and you're still developing the product, is a very common balancing act. I will say that a lot of teams we talk to, they're not watching their cash position too closely, and they realize that they're 3 to 4 weeks or 6 weeks from being out of cash, and that forces some hard decisions that they probably should have made when they had 4 to 6 months of cash and would be better able to execute it. So at some level, the lack of cash forces the decisions. If you can artificially put yourself in that frame of mind, I think you get more realistic about what's going to happen.
It's difficult to project cash flow when you're starting off because you're not really sure where you're going to end up. I know for myself, my experience was I had planned my product, and I took many, many months writing software in the evening. But what I found was as the product started looking better and better and better, I very much enjoyed working on it more and more and more. And then when I set a date I was going to leave my day job, it just became easier and easier and easier to do because I would see the fruits of my work, and I had more and more information that I could move forward going in that step. So if you keep your day job and you find yourself working part-time on this new business you're going to do, if you break it into manageable chunks where you can see the progress yourself, that might be motivating enough to keep you going at your day job until you can make that leap.
The other thing is, if you know you're going to leave your job, a lot of things that are irritations become much more manageable.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
I think, you know, in other words, you say to yourself, I got to do this for another year. That's different necessarily from I'm stuck here for the rest of my life, or I'm going to do this for another 4 to 6 months.
Sure, you're going somewhere.
You're going somewhere. The sense that you're going somewhere allows you to put up with a lot of irritation in the workplace. And I think that's, in some cases, not a bad frame of mind to be in.
Well, I had a funny experience. I had planned my exit from the day job, and I knew what the date was. No one else knew. And about 3 months before the exit, and I really saw it coming. I knew I was going to be able to make my exit day. My boss told me what a pleasure I was to work with lately, you know, and I guess I was a pretty demanding marketing person. And I remember laughing because all of a sudden I wasn't looking at my job for the long haul. I was just looking at managing the day-to-day operations of what I had to do. And that de-stressed me quite a bit, and it made working on my own project in the evening that much more enjoyable. And so in the process of planning your exit from your company, you get that benefit You know, you can put up with anything for a short term or a lot of stress for the short term. But I found that I had more time to devote to my own venture once I put my day job in its proper perspective. It was just a filler job until I was ready to go.
Part of it involves, I think, surrendering your career, right? In other words, if you give up on the idea that I'm going to move up to the next slot or I'm going to have a career at where I am now, I'm just going to do a good job every day that I'm here. It becomes more day to day, a little bit. You can just let a lot of things go, right?
Absolutely. And I meet a lot of people on the verge of not sure they want to start a company. And I always encourage them to do it for the reason that when you surrender your career, I was in marketing and there's, you know, product manager, and you move up into, you know, all the titles that come up through the marketing channel. What I found was when I started my own business, I became CEO. So I didn't really surrender my career. I embarked on a new career that became a CEO title. And once you start, you know, hanging out at Bootstrapper Breakfast and things like that with other CEOs, the nature of your peer group changed. I don't miss what I would have become had I stayed in the corporate world anymore, because I'm quite happy being at the bottom rung of a new ladder, which was a CEO ladder. And I think that transition of giving up your career, whatever it is, the safety or alleged safety of going to this new career, I'm much happier taking the plunge. And most of the people I know that I convinced to start their own businesses are glad they did it, even if the businesses didn't work out.
I never try and convince people to start a business. I think that I'm not trying to be argumentative. I just think that it's
go ahead.
entrepreneurship is way too popular, and I think it requires a certain frame of mind and a certain set of personality characteristics that. It's romanticized way too much, and it's way, way harder than it looks.
Absolutely. And of course, I don't, you know, I'm not talking necessarily to strangers. Usually I'm talking to people that have something. That's why they're in my office. And they're trying to decide how best to monetize it. And if they express some type of interest of starting their own company, I'm probably going to be leaning way more towards encouraging them to do it, unless I see signs that maybe they it's not their skill set. People with business experience pondering the idea of starting a business on their own, I'm going to be encouraging. And one of the things I'll tell them is that I'm glad I made the plunge. But I agree with you. There's probably a lot of people that are shy of all the skill sets you need. An entrepreneur is a pretty dynamic job title. And you need to be a little bit of everything to pull it off. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that don't have a little bit of everything.
I am much more of a Dutch uncle. I mean, I will try and give people a very realistic assessment of what's involved. And if they've made real progress, then I will be encouraging based on the progress. But I don't anymore have a default, bias towards I guess I really believe for the most part, people are entrepreneurs for reasons that are outside of their control. And if you're really questioning if you should do something or not, you should probably find a way to get along with your boss and keep your day job. I know that's kind of heresy in Silicon Valley, but.
Yeah, it sounds that way a little bit. I think it's very situational, and it depends on the type of person that you're talking to. And, but anyhow, obviously I'm very happy as an entrepreneur. And I like working with that part of the world in the entrepreneurship side, but I like the excitement of it. And maybe that's part of the adrenaline rush that just comes with being around a new idea and looking at possibilities.
Right. But you and I live somewhat unbalanced lives.
That's true.
Compared to the people that hold real jobs and are, you know, Boy Scout leaders or, you know, whatever. I mean,
they have lives outside of work.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, you need a little bit of cayenne pepper in the elephant stew, but it's mainly elephant. You need people that keep society going, that are stable and show up for work every day and don't necessarily have, you know, an entirely new way of doing things this morning that I just thought of.
Yeah, and there's certainly something to be said for economic stability. And I suppose my advice changes dependent on their family situation. You know, if you have kids at home and you know people depending on you to bring home a salary, to bring home a regular check, entrepreneurship is definitely out. Those type of things.
I think in that case, you do it part time and you find ways to test the market and you make an agreement with your spouse in terms of, here's the risks I'm going to run. Here's how we're going to do it. I'm going to prosecute this in a business-like fashion. And
sure. And I think if you have a good set of skills, you can find. The entrepreneurs I meet are always looking. You know, we're looking for that 1/16th of the new employee, right? And maybe you can sell that 1/16th skill for a little bit of equity, a small chunk, in a lot of different companies as you go along. It turns out at the, you know, the early stage they need a product designer or interface designer or something. If that's your skill set, you can do that for just a small chunk as they go by and pick a new, you know, company every 3 months or 6 months or whatever the cycle is, and get the thrill of entrepreneurship without having to give up your day job. And who knows, if one of them hits, you can be quite happy with it.
I think I think doing that also gives you a much more realistic perspective on what's involved with actually doing a startup, mm-hmm. as opposed to what they call the montage scene where they, you know, when they show how in the movies where they collapse 9 months of hard work into 3 minutes of an inspiring music video, right?
Yeah,
as an entrepreneur, many times in that 9 months, you're kind of up at 3 a.m. going, I got what I asked for. I should have been more specific, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Or wondering how you're going to find time to sleep before tomorrow morning's meeting. Yeah, that's right. Which is more important, being awake at the meeting or getting this done before the meeting? So, I don't have any regrets about that. But you're right. We lead our lives are not centered like everybody else, I suppose.
You know, we laugh about that. I had a startup with a French guy at 94, and I was in a Kinko's over in Cupertino, and I hadn't been there in a very long time. I was thinking, this feels really familiar. I'm getting this weird sensation. When was the last time I was there? And I realized that it had been in 94, and he and I had been up all night working at the Kinko's on something to get ready for a presentation that morning, right? And there came a point when we go, you know what? We're just going to drink more coffee and we'll sleep after the presentation, right? Which is, you know, example of bad planning and a few other things. We actually did win the deal. But
good for you.
You're back in that, you're kind of in this mode where, you know, kind of bad planning sometimes bites you in the ass. So
yeah, well, I was a techie. We can talk later. I won't have to swap stories on a podcast.
any last minute piece of advice on this whole early finding the right team and splitting the pie with them?
No, I think we kind of covered most of the topics that come to my mind right now.
Well, thank you very much. This has been Pete Tormey and Sean Murphy.